Shrink Wrap Radio number 888. Osteopathic psychiatrist James Champion on medical school adventures.
And now it's time for Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
James Champion is a psychiatrist practicing in Appalachia. He supervises psychiatry residents, teaches medical students, and collaborates with nurse practitioners. He has a DO degree from an Appalachian medical school and lives in Tennessee. Adventures of an American Medical Student, a novel, is his first book. We'll be discussing his real-life experiences as a psychiatrist in Appalachia, as well as his medical school recollections. Now, here's the interview. Dr. J, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks for having me. It's an honor to be on your program.
Well, congratulations on getting your first book out there, a novel, which is titled Adventures of an American Medical Student. And we're going to be discussing your novel along with your actual experiences as a medical student and clinical experience as a psychiatrist. First of all, I wanted to share with you my reaction to your name, James Champion. I introduced you just now as Dr. J, because I suspected that the name just struck me as so heroic, so perfect in a way that that it was probably a nom de plume, a pseudonym. And you and I had a conversation earlier in which you confirmed that that was the case. But I didn't find out what led you to make that choice.
Yeah, first I got a chuckle out of you thinking that might have been a pseudonym. So a couple of authors who influenced me early on years ago were Michael Crichton and Samuel Shim. They were physicians turned authors. And in their early books, they used pseudonyms. And I would say The House of God was my biggest influence for having me to think about writing a similar book. And I decided to use a pseudonym because I wanted anonymity. And the cases in the book, there are many cases, are based on real cases that I've seen, but I was careful to protect the anonymity of the patients. And I thought that it would also be good to have a layer, an extra layer between them and me in this work of fiction. It is marketed as a novel. According to my publisher, it has to be called that for the North American market because it is fiction, but more specifically, it's a fictionalized memoir. So it is based heavily on my experience in medical school, but other influences I had since then have contributed as well. The name actually, you know, I spent some time thinking about it, and Champion, of course, it does sound like, you know, a really powerful name, but that happened to be the maiden name of my mother as well.
And, oh, really?
And my paternal grandfather's first name was James. So I incorporated some family into the pseudonym there, and I thought that was kind of cool. And my sister, who's an avid reader, also told me that my book, she was the first one to really read it and like serve as my editor initially. And she said that it reminded her of James Herriot books, which are based on his experience as a veterinarian, and he also used that was a pseudonym as well. So I just kind of followed other influences in that regard in my decision to do that.
Well, it's interesting to me to hear the substance that was behind that decision. And I also, there were a lot of clues that suggested to me that this quote novel hewed pretty close to your life experience in many ways. There are little clues that you dropped in when you in your appreciations and so on that suggested that to me, which
Yeah,
is
as for,
great.
yeah, sorry, didn't mean to interrupt.
No, okay, feel free.
Oh, I was just going to say, I also wrote the book in memory of my mother. So she was very special to me. She was a great woman. And there's a little part in the book based on her as well. So I felt good about using her maiden name. I was writing the book in memory of her as well.
The book starts off with a bang, describing an emergency case that you experience of someone who's overdosed on OxyContin, which you refer to as hillbilly heroin.
Yes.
And you were working in Appalachia. You lived and worked in the Appalachian area. So talk about OxyContin. Is that a big problem there? Is that a big issue?
Yes, and that is dealt with in the book as well. Eastern Kentucky has been plagued by poverty and unemployment and people on disability for generations. It's a generational problem. And people have, politicians and such have tried to fix the problem. But long story short is that, the opioid crisis has been talked about as a national crisis. But it was a much bigger crisis, I think, in Eastern Kentucky and other areas of the country similar to that, well before I think it was recognized as a national crisis. So people in the area called the OxyContin hillbilly heroin because it was easier to obtain than actual heroin, and it was an opioid like heroin. And unfortunately, there were a number of pill mills in the area that contributed to this. One of them was run by Dr. Catherine Hoover, and that's the actual fact. You can look up information about her and find like an NBC News article about her and the others she worked with. And so there were clinics like that, and that one was just across the border in West Virginia. So some of my experience in medical school, I don't mind saying I went to the Kentucky College of Osteopathic Medicine. So sorry, I just lost my train of thought for a minute. There, he'll, sorry, I'm just losing my train of thought.
Well, we were talking about OxyContin and you're talking about this unethical doctor, and there are unethical people mentioned in the book, maybe not by their real names, but it was an easy way for shady psychiatrists to prescribe pills
Yeah, I
and
think what I just kind of got off track when I was talking about doing rotations in Kentucky versus West Virginia. The problem was so big that there were millions of dollars that the Pike County was one of the governments, along with others in other parts of the country, that sued the manufacturers of OxyContin because it was such a big crisis there. So that kind of money ended up being spent to build jails to house more people who ran into these problems. Years later, after I finished medical school, the feds not surprisingly raided Catherine Hoover's practice and shut all that down. And that kind of information can be found in the articles as well. We do have a treatment for the opioid crisis now, Suboxone, but despite, and we have methadone as well. Buprenorphine is the generic name of Suboxone. That is a newer treatment. But despite having that treatment for decades now, it continues to be an ongoing problem.
Yeah, is Narcan the same thing that you're
Oh,
talking
yes,
about?
that I'm sorry. I was talking about you're right. There are other treat there's another treatment naltrexone. Narcan is naloxone that is used as a rescue kind of medication if someone overdoses.
Right. And I learned about that years ago in another interview that I did, and I was surprised to learn about it. And there was a lot of enthusiasm about that. Oh, because it was being used in Scandinavia. Now it comes back to me, and I wondered, well, why aren't we, why aren't we taking advantage of that? And as time
Yeah,
went by, we got on board.
I was involved a few years ago with a program with the agency I work with now for providing the Suboxone treatment for patients. And I just found after a couple of years I felt like it wasn't a good fit for me, but there are plenty of other people that do this and it can certainly save lives. But even with this kind of treatment, there are problems with these kind of patients of them diverting the medication. Like if they get two pills of Suboxone, then they may keep one or less than one for themselves and they sell or give the medication to others. And Suboxone is unique among the opioid agonists used to treat opioid use disorder because it has a ceiling effect with respiratory depression. So you can take a lot of it. And your chance of dying of a fatal overdose is actually very low. However, if the medication is injected, even if it is combined with a naloxone, which is supposed to be a deterrent, if it's injected with benzodiazepines, then that does increase the risk of dying of an overdose from the Suboxone.
Okay. Now you had a passion to your ultimate goal was to become a psychiatrist. And but I don't think you really in the book, I don't know that you gave much of a rationale for that. Where did that passion to be because a number of the doctors the fictional doctors, I assume, but I think probably in reality dumped on the idea as you doctors who were training you during your various rotations, and they would kind of, why do you want to do that? You're so talented in anatomy and other areas, and there's just not a lot of respect universally in the medical profession for psychiatry. So how did you land on that?
Yeah, I think I dealt with that briefly in the book, but didn't maybe go into deep detail about it. When I started medical school, I didn't actually consider psychiatry as a career at all. I don't think it was even on my radar as a medical specialty to pursue. I was thinking of fields like family medicine or internal medicine or maybe orthopedic surgery because I like to fix things and do things with my hands. But in my second year of medical school, we had a visiting psychiatrist who spent about half his time teaching and half his time practicing, who gave us 2 full days. I think there were 8-hour days of lectures about psychiatry on various topics. And I just found myself so interested in it. I was like, wow, I think this is what I want to do. This is really interesting to me. So after that experience in our it was during the first 2 years of medical school are mostly books and exams, little clinical experience. So I told myself I needed to get some clinical experience to make sure I liked the clinical aspect. And the first psychiatry rotation I had was for a psychiatric hospital in Eastern Kentucky. And I found that I really enjoyed the experience. So that kind of sealed the deal for me. Because I also started a medical school a little later in life, I wanted to be sure that whatever path I pursued, what I was going to be happy with. Because some people will pursue a residency and then decide they don't like it and
Right.
change to something else, or even sometimes after being out of residency for a while, they'll go back and train in something else because they weren't happy. So I even bought a book about applying to medical residency and took a personality test and saw, okay, my personality kind of aligns and my background aligns with the kind of people that go into the field. So that was confirmation for me too. And I schedule a couple of other psychiatry rotations besides that. And I continue to pursue that path, and I haven't regretted it.
Yeah, what is it that you like about it? What is it that pulls you? And you can and you say you have no regrets, so I assume you haven't regretted that choice. You continue to be happy. Where does the satisfaction come from?
The satisfaction comes from connections with patients. I found in medical school that I was more interested in patient stories rather than their lab values and test results. And that's very important in psychiatry or psychology, as you know. You have to spend time talking with people and learn about them. What are their interests? What are their fears? What are they anxious about? And that kind of stuff. So you have to take a good history, whatever kind of doctor you are, but I think you have to go into more detail and be more interested in a person's psychosocial history, which has a great bearing on mental health. And so I, you know, the of course it's not all, you know, sunshine and rainbows, of course, because I've worked in community mental health for over 8 years now, and I worked as a prison psychiatrist for a year or two when I first got out of residency. It can be very challenging at times because you can have really difficult patients that just kind of drain the energy out of you. But then I'm mindful of the patients who are appreciative and who are getting better. We see a lot of patients with treatment-resistant illness, so we see a lot of people who continue to have great struggles despite our best efforts to help them. But you know, I may get a complaint one day, and sometimes complaints, you know, you have to deal with corporate people when someone complains about something. But then another day, I'll get some sweet card in the mail from a nice old lady who thanks me for how much I've helped her and that sort of thing. And so I'm mindful of those kind of patients, and that helps to balance it.
And so many of the people that you describe in the book, and I think in reality, have multiple diagnoses. And blocking on the term for that. But it,
Like dual diagnosis patients, perhaps?
yeah, or multiple, not just dual. I mean, a lot of the people that you describe it during your various rotations. And including the psychiatric rotation, had multiple problems that they were dealing with. You know, diabetes being one that you mentioned a lot, and other comorbidity was the word I was looking for.
That's quite common, and that's a good point because in community mental health, overall, our population in this kind of practice is much more ill physically than the general population, because a lot of these people don't are poor are not so good at self-care. And I have, for instance, seen plenty of patients who are good about keeping appointments with me and taking their medications and complying with all the treatment recommendations. But then when it comes to taking care of their physical health, you know, I repeatedly remind them, hey, you know, you've got some lab abnormalities here, you've got your blood sugar isn't good, your cholesterol's not good, you need to follow up with a primary care provider. And some patients just aren't good about that. So again, despite our best efforts to help people, our population still has higher morbidity and mortality. So they tend to lead sicker lives and shorter lives.
Yeah, you're referring to the poor people in Appalachia, right?
Yeah, and I'm referring generally to m community mental health practice as well, but yes, in
Okay.
Appalachia as well.
Yeah.
And then when you have all of this illness and you have on top of that unemployment or disability, data shows that areas of the country that hi have higher rates of unemployment and disability have higher rates of opioid use as well. And they can look at the data based on prescriptions. And the other thing that I meant to say earlier that it just came back to me was that with Pike County suing the makers of OxyContin, that also what was happening in West Virginia is West Virginia had the highest rate of opioid overdose deaths. And this doctor who was prescribing this stuff was, she prescribed a ridiculous number of prescriptions and a lot of patients she never saw. So that contributes to all of this cycle with these poor, downtrodden people and all of their illness and the unfortunately mortality from it too.
Yeah, there's a character that you talk about in the book who I assume has some correspondence in reality, who had big billboard signs. And what was he offering?
Yeah, this, oh, yeah, so this is related to the problems in the area as well. Eric C. Kahn, I thought it was quite humorous that his last name happened to be Kahn because he was really a
Yeah.
con artist.
Wow.
He had gaudy billboards, radio and TV ads just blanketing Eastern Kentucky about like being Mr. Social Security, your disability expert. And so he helped to, he committed so much fraud that he ended up getting, I think it started with a Senate investigation and then it was turned over to the Justice Department. And he tried to flee, I think went down to Honduras and was captured there and brought back. And now he's serving time in prison for Social Security disability fraud because, oh, he would have other corrupt people working with him, of course, like corrupt psychiatrists and judges who would basically rubber stamp applications. And so they were putting a lot of people on, who knows how many people got disability that really didn't need it.
Wow.
And
One of the things I found myself wondering was how much of your current work as a psychiatrist is case management and dispensing of medications, and how much. What percentage is psychotherapy? Do you find yourself doing some form of psychotherapy much or not?
I don't do psychotherapy unless you would consider some of the work I do brief supportive therapy. The reality, and for most psychiatrists in America, is that with the corporatization of medicine and how insurance reimbursement is structured,
Right.
people who need therapy are, typically get that from a master's trained therapist. There are psychologists as well, not at the agency that I work that provide that service. But my primary role is just medication management for patients. But if I think someone needs case management or psychotherapy and they're agreeable, then I will certainly refer them for those services.
Okay. So
And we're
where is it that you're working now that happens? Is it some kind of a community agency?
yeah, it's a community mental health agency in East Tennessee. And we're a multidisciplinary team. We share the same medical record. So if I'm seeing a patient who's also been involved in case management and or psychotherapy, I can easily see the visit notes from those appointments too. And we can always communicate with each other if we think we need to help people out. I think it's kind of sad in a way when you think about how psychiatrists are trained. We received extensive training in psychotherapy and residency. We received training in dynamic psychotherapy and cognitive behavioral therapy. And yet, as I said, the psychiatrists who practice therapy are typically ones who set up a cash-only kind of practice in an affluent area where people can afford to pay them for therapy because the reimbursement rates are so low from insurance companies for it. So I think we were, it's very, therapy is, of course, of various sorts are very valuable modalities. And I wish that there could be a swing back towards a biopsychosocial approach instead of a biomedical approach. I say that purposefully because I recently listened to a CME lecture by a psychiatrist who advocates for shifting back that way because psychiatry has shifted so far to what are your symptoms and here's the medication for it that the human interaction and being more interested in the patients as people has suffered. And when you can connect more with patients as other human beings, then they'll tend to have better self-care and be more likely to follow recommendations like taking medications and such.
Yeah. Unfortunately, what you're saying is no surprise to me. It's the same thing has gone on across the nation, that
Yeah.
with the way that ma managed care and the insurance industry have, have created a basically an industrial model, and a very hierarchical model, and we talk about the bean counters and paper pushers
Yeah.
off at the top, who often have no training in either medicine or but they're just corporate business people.
Yeah,
And
it's in
so
corporate
that's a
business.
real,
Sorry, go
yeah.
ahead.
Oh, you go ahead.
Well, corporate business people typically push for productivity, like how many patients are you seeing, and they want
Right.
you to see as many as possible. At some point, you got to draw the line and say, hey, I need time to see these people. And
Yeah.
in my practice, actually, I get 20 minutes for follow-up appointments with established patients and 40 minutes for new evals. Some practices will have 15 minutes for med check appointments. I actually consider it like a luxury that I have 20 minutes, but that time can quickly go by when you're seeing a complex patient,
Yeah.
especially if they're having all kinds of problems they need to discuss.
Well, I need to ask you about osteopathic medicine, because you went to osteopathic school. How and why did that happen? It's kind of a rare thing.
It is kind of rare, but not as rare as it used to be. There's a little bit of information in the book about statistically how the osteopathic profession in terms of number of physicians being produced has grown exponentially. But honestly, so I decided to apply to medical school years after graduating from college. So I'm what you'd call a non-traditional, I was a non-traditional medical school applicant. Most people go to medical school within, right after college or within a year or two of
Right.
graduating. So going back to take courses to apply for medical school years later was daunting. And I had to study to take the MCAT, the Medical College Admissions Test, and that was daunting too after being out of college for years and taking an organic chemistry post-baccalaureate. So my MCAT scores were okay, but not great. And way back in college years ago, when I had taken, I was having too much fun in college and didn't put forth the effort with a chemistry and physics class because I got a C and one and an F in the other, I think, and I retook them and got better grades. But they still look at the whole transcript when I was applying to
Right.
MD schools and my MCAT score not quite being competitive enough, but DOs were more receptive to non-traditional applicants and those who weren't perfect with all of their academics, other than and then the MCAT score not being really competitive and the those couple of classes that I messed up with, it was fine otherwise. So when I applied to DO schools, they were much more receptive. I got interviews, and I decided that I liked the holistic philosophy too, and it was interesting to learn in medical school about osteopathic manipulative medicine. The training for to become a DO or osteopathic physician versus a allopathic or MD physician is basically the same, except for I think the holistic philosophy of osteopathic medicine and the extra training in musculoskeletal medicine. And the osteopathic manipulative therapy or OMT can also be a very valuable treatment to help people with all kinds of ailments.
Yeah, I've actually seen a DO over the years, off and on, for some, I guess you'd call them musculoskeletal problems, and she's very good. She has trained lots of people in our local area, and I appreciate the holistic approach, which clearly she subscribed to, and that resonated well with me.
Sure.
I was blown away going through your book. You go through all of these rotations. I didn't even know there were that many rotations out there. I felt like I went to medical school reading the book because, you really go into great detail about each of the rotations and the sorts of problems that you were confronting in each of those rotations and so on. So I can heartily recommend the book if somebody wants to get just as your purpose was to give people a taste of what it is to go to medical school. So it's interesting that even though you were sort of your primary interests were in two sort of offbeat areas, you ended up getting exposed to everything and having to learn about everything. One of the, and I assume this happened in your real life, one of the doctor trainers that you were rotating under remarked on your expertise in anatomy. And did that really happen?
Yes, I like I said earlier when I was thinking about when I started medical school and I was thinking about potential specialties to choose, orthopedic surgery was one of them. That's a highly competitive specialty, but I think I was interested in that because you go in and fix things, you get results. And I really enjoyed my anatomy course in my first year of school. And because osteopathic schools have this extra training in osteopathic manipulative medicine, there's even more of a focus on anatomy. And I found that really interesting. So I think that you may be referring to the protagonist in the book, James Banks, who I think it was a surgeon or someone he was working with him who commented about his knowledge of anatomy. So I think that was just a natural result of the education before he started his clinical experience.
Yeah, well, you were actually, and the character in the book was complimented on. They would send you home with questions to think. You had to say, "I don't know." They would sort of challenge you, and to see just how much of the reading you were doing and your level of expertise. And so I came away impressed that there's so much detail about the human body that it's all been mapped. And so if there's a name for everything, and you kind of could, you had to learn that, oh, the and I can't name it, the things that you were talking about, but oh, that place is, 2 centimeters over here and 3 centimeters above that, and down to that level of detail as a map with everything, with the complexity of the human body, and over the years with all the study, that it's all been mapped. And for me, that was kind of an eye opener, and I can understand why that's the case, and it's a good thing
Yeah, because when a
that it.
surgeon is cutting on you, he or she has to really know their landmarks to avoid structures that you don't want to accidentally cut.
Exactly. Yeah, that really came through. And I'm impressed too that as an osteopath, you had to learn all of that stuff, but even more. Like you had a whole nother body of knowledge on top of all those rotations, you had to know even more.
Yeah, I do think that added to the challenges because in our exams throughout our first 2 years of medical school and the medical licensing exams that we subsequently had to take, you have to go through three licensing exams to finally get your license. There were questions about osteopathic manipulative medicine and all of those exams. And some of them could really kind of twist your brain in knots. And I think some of that kind of comes through in the book when you're talking about getting down to anatomical structure and function, and talking about how, for instance, a vertebrae is out of place, how do you describe that? And you, for instance, would say, well, this particular vertebrae is flex side bent rotate forward, and it goes from there and becomes more complex. But to see some of these osteopaths who were had this extra interest in continuing the neuromusculoskeletal medicine, they were really like impressive gurus in how well they could work with people and get changes that would really give people relief from their ailments. It was really cool to see that in person.
And a lot of it is interpersonal skill, right? I mean, getting back to the sort of verging on the psychiatric therapeutic interest. Doesn't a lot of that healing in the osteopathic arena happen as a result of a kind of the holistic approach, talking to the person about their life
Yes, exactly. I see. I think that the osteopathic background has influenced my psychiatric practice, and that I do my best to treat patients as a whole person, and that includes like mental, physical, spiritual health. And a lot of people in mental health don't talk as much about spiritual health, but I don't mind saying that I identify as a Christian, so I have that bias that I bring to my work, but I do my best to, be a psychiatrist and not like someone who's going to proselytize people. But for instance, if someone is going through a really hard time, maybe they've lost a loved one or they're facing a cancer diagnosis, where I practice is in the Bible Belt of the country, and a lot of people identify as Christians, whether they go to church or not. And oftentimes I'll just use this as an opportunity to just ask a simple question like, do you have any spiritual or religious beliefs? What are they? And sometimes I'll, if someone says, yeah, but I haven't been to church in a while, then I may just say, well, consider getting back to church because that may help you with a sense of community, socialization, and it could be beneficial for your mental health.
Is there who do you think is going to benefit from this book? Who's your the audience in that you have in mind when you wrote it?
Well, this book was actually kind of intimidating for me to write because I actually, I wrote it years after graduating from medical school. So I had to do a lot of research because I wanted to make sure that it would stand up to scrutiny of other physicians in these different specialties. So I would, and I'm in, congratulations for making it through it because some people will say, oh, it's got too much jargon in there. But I tried to explain jargon in footnotes for people who don't understand it all. But my target audience, I think, is pre-medical students, medical students, and physicians, because I'm thinking about this as a case book that is entertaining. So I think it's unique among medical fiction. Most medical fiction is written to entertain, but I think this has high educational value for pre-medical students, medical students, and physicians. One of my friends from medical school, who was in the class ahead of me, he trained as an internist and is now working in emergency medicine. He enjoyed the book, and he made the comment that this book basically covers 90% of the cases a student would typically see during their training. So I think it could be very valuable in helping to for pre-medical students, so they can get an idea of what's medical school like. That would give you an idea of what the clinical years are like. And I think it could help to prepare medical students for their clinical training if they read the book in their first or second year. And for some physicians might find it entertaining and as a refreshing review. That's another comment my friend Dr. Hilliard made about it.
Yeah, I would include people in the mental health arena to have a sort of more in-depth appreciation of what's going on in the medical side, and more appreciative if they're in a team environment, a better understanding of the medical people on the team, who've gone through that other training. So. So, well, is there anything else that you want to say that we haven't touched on here?
I enjoyed your questions. I agree with your last point that I was also thinking, I think it comes through in the book that though I cover a broad range of specialties, that there's a heavier focus on psychiatry because that's what I was interested in and I did more rotations in that. So I think that comes through. A lot of people consider psychiatry an oddball specialty. And there's plenty of jokes in the book about other doctors saying, oh, so you don't want to be a real doctor. But I
Right.
take that all that in stride. A lot of people don't know what a DO is, and a lot of people don't know what a psychiatrist is, but that's okay with me. And I think my passion for my field comes through in the book and what I find so interesting about it. And I do think that the parts of it that deal with mental health and addiction as well might have educational value for other people in the mental health field too.
Okay, well, I want to thank you for being my guest. What name should I thank?
James Champion.
Dr. James Champion, thanks so much for being such a champion and writing this very instructive book. And I wish you Godspeed in your work.
Thank you very much. It was nice talking to you and honored to be on your show.
My recent guest, Dr. James Champion, DO, is a doctor of osteopathic medicine. He's a psychiatrist, actually, who has written a novel about attending medical school in the United States. James Champion sounds like such a heroic choice of a name that I felt certain that it was a nom de plume. Turns out I was wrong. He actually has good cause to use that name, inasmuch as his mother's maiden name was Champion and a favorite uncle was named James. He went to school in Appalachia and has been practicing as a psychiatrist there for 10 years. I have some experience personally with the osteopathic medical approach, having seen a practitioner for a number of years, off and on, for various aches and pains, and I know it to be a holistic approach. James himself attended an osteopathic medical school, and it turns out that he's not less of a doctor for having done so, because he had to learn the osteopathic techniques and philosophy and approach over and above all the material that one learns in a regular medical school. It turns out that his novel hews very closely to his actual experience in medical school. And if you read the book, you're going to learn a lot of medicine in the process. He takes us through all the various rotations that he did in his training, and believe me, there were plenty of them. His book will be of special value to anyone planning to go to medical school or who is in medical school or in pre-med. At the same time, I believe those of us in mental health professions will learn valuable information about the rigors of the training that our medical and psychiatric colleagues have endured. Also, the book highlights the challenges of people living in Appalachia, so much of whom are living in poverty. Particularly, we learn about the scourge of OxyContin in that area, and that it was abused so widely as to be called hillbilly heroin. The book is very readable, and I recommend it to one and all.
Al Tabor here. I've been a listener of Shrink Wrap Radio since, episode 20, and a regular contributor, actually, almost since then. I've been upping my contribution as circumstances allowed, and I think you should be a contributor too. The reason I'm contributing is that I'm receiving something of great value. I always learn something, which is a prime consideration for me, and often something that changes how I view the world. What could be better than that? So we all need to chip in and keep Dr. Dave on the main line. In fact, I recently doubled down on my contribution, figuring that I would kick in a little towards folks that can't pay. Now, for you folks that know you should pay but haven't, and you know who you are, it's probably time to kick a little bit into the pot. So let's keep Dr. Dave broadcasting and keep the good stuff coming.
Thank you, Al Tabor. You've been such a steadfast supporter from the beginning. Also, thank you for encouraging others to follow your fine example. Time once again to shrink wrap it up. Big thanks to osteopath psychiatrist James Champion for his information-rich book and interview. Next week, my guests will be psychiatrist Will Vanderveer speaking about psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy and his training and certification program to bring other professionals into the field. I hope you will join us then. And until then, this is Dr. Dave reminding you to be kind to yourselves, others, and our precious Earth.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.